Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. "100 Years of Betty" by Deborah Oswald was long listed for the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025. She's written for film, television, stage, radio, fiction, and children's fiction, graced in each area of writing with innumerable awards. Welcome, Deborah Oswald, to Imagining the Past.
Thank you, Greg.
You've had a long and quite varied career in various forms of writing. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of an overview of that and also address kind of what initially made you want to write.
Writing at all?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I started writing when I was a teenager. I mean, I told my parents I was going to be a playwright when I was 12, or that I wanted to be a playwright. And I sold my first radio play to ABC Drama when I was 17.
Wow.
So after uni, I've never had a real job. I wrote theatre and television, and I wrote my first children's novel when I was 28. So I've always bounced between theatre and screen and fiction. And there was a period there when I did a lot of television, things like Bananas in Pyjamas and Police Rescue and Palace of Dreams, which was a historical series. And I'm probably best known in television for a series called Offspring that ran, that I was head writer on for 5 series. But then in the last 10 years, I've focused on novels.
Right. So the CYA fiction was almost kind of concurrent with your playwriting. I'm just kind of, what attracted you to CYA initially as well, like young adult fiction?
I remember my childhood and my teenage years very vividly. And I suppose I think so much of who you are is formed by that period in your life. So that to tell stories about that time in a person's life, the stakes are very high. You can still be playful and have fun with it, but it seems to matter.
Mm.
You know, there's something about, you know, if a kid goes to see one of my plays for young people, chances are that play is going to have more impact on, they're going to remember it much more than any play they see as an adult. I mean, if you think about things that you read or saw when you were 15, they stay with you and they shape who you are. And I suppose maybe the power fiend in me quite liked the idea that I would have that impact on some kids.
Yeah, I'm interested though that you had, even at that younger age, the introspection of your youth, because, you know, my memories of my 20s, I guess, was ploughing forward. I didn't feel like I had a lot of time to look back at that time.
All right, that's interesting. I think because I wanted to be a storyteller, I mean, I started writing what I called novels. One of them was set in the Gold Rush when I was 10. So I think I always looked at life that way and sort of transformed what I was thinking and feeling into story.
So you were literally mining your own life for stories.
And sticky beaking on everybody else's and saw life that way, I suppose.
So in the broad scheme of it all, I get, it sounds like adult fiction was something kind of newer to you, that you came to that a bit later.
That's right. And I think it was because in the past, if I had an original idea for adults that I was burning to tell, I would write it as a stage play. But as theatre became more difficult and my patience for dealing with the difficulties of the theatre was worn thin, if I then had an original idea that I wanted to do, a novel seemed like the way to do it. Because in television, there's lots of advantages to television to do with working, you know, the fun of working with other people and reaching a big audience, but you don't have the kind of control to just set out and tell the story you want to tell. So I decided that novels would be a way for me to do that.
Yeah, I mean, those other mediums must be much more working as a committee than a solitary or a sole kind of voice.
Yes, and but then that's part of the fun of them too, that you know, when you work with wonderful people, as I did on Offspring with two amazing writers, there's this incredible alchemy that can happen in a writer's room where everyone's bringing out the best, not just bringing out the best in each other, but creating something that wouldn't have been created without that combination of people. And I do still miss that a lot.
Yeah. Like, it always surprises me when we watch a film that really works and that I really love. And when it gets to the end and you just got this roll of credits of all these people who've been involved. And I often kind of think, you know, how does a film ever get made?
Yes.
In terms of getting all of this coordinated to the one end.
Yes, I think that's right. And so the thing with fiction is that I have the chance to put down exactly what I, well, I should say, I have the chance to put down what I hope is exactly what I want to say, but there's always a gap between what you imagine you can do and the limit and your own ability. There's always a gap, but at least nobody's telling me what to do.
Right. So what were the first ideas you had for 100 Years of Betty? How did all of this come about?
It really sprang from me thinking about my own mum, who was born kind of pretty much the same time and place as Betty. She was one of 12 in South London. And I just thought about how much the world changed in the course of her life. And I personally really love whole of life novels. I mean, Any Human Heart by William Boyd is one of my favourites. And novels where there's a big sweep of time. So that I was drawn to that idea. And I suppose I was particularly drawn to the idea of how much the world changed for women. And maybe there was a slight kind of wanting to illuminate things for younger women, for them to understand how tough it was and how much we all owe women who worked very hard to make things better. I mean, obviously the feminism is only one strand in it, but it was one of the strands that was probably part of the initial fire.
All right. So I kind of, one of the things I really appreciated about the novel was it kind of seems that publishing in the, the advent of multiculturalism and migrant stories has kind of almost forgotten the British kind of migrant experience. And I also kind of feel like that experience of British migration is kind of denigrated in a way, in that people who came from Britain were one type of person who came from Britain, which is absurd, really, given the variety of people who live there. But also that when they got to Australia, they just meshed into the Australian culture like a hand going into a glove, which I from my own experience is just not correct. So was that kind of part of what interested you with Betty as well, that her experience was a migrant experience into Australia?
Yes, I think it seems to me that if there's two big narratives about Australia. One is the dispossession of the Indigenous people, and the other is that we're, apart from the Indigenous people, we're a nation of people who left where they came from. And part of the joy of that is the variety of people, but a lot of them were British. And I suppose I told that story because that's the story that I'm familiar with through my mum. But I just think there's something so astonishingly brave about people, particularly when they came as single people, leaving everything they knew at a time when there was no real way to have proper communication. And I suppose there was something kind of thrilling from a narrative point of view about the idea of all these people, not just Betty, but Leo and Pearl and Athena, the people she meets on the boat, coming to create themselves, to be a new person, create a new life, which coming to Australia, you know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, easy, and you couldn't get away from who you were. I mean, part of the story is about the fact that you can't escape who you were as a little kid, but still you could start and have a fresh new life. And I look at my mother's life compared to her siblings who didn't leave, and I think she had broader horizons than she would have had if she'd stayed.
Yeah. I just think, like, I mean, the whole migrant experience just has always fired up my imagination, and it took me a long while to realize kind of why. And it partially, I think, is because I grew up in my mother's parents both came from Manchester, well, kind of between the wars, but there was a bit of overlap. So I grew up in this household that there were two people who didn't sound like everybody else that I met on the street. And, you know, there were letters that came from England, and news that came from England that was often upsetting. So, and just this presence of England. So it took a long while for me to realize that experience and my kind of experience in that shadow was not so different to Italian people growing up here, or even Vietnamese people growing up here as migration went on. So it's that's what I kind of appreciated about your novel, is it kind of foregrounded that British experience, which I think is, like I said before, I think sometimes it's just forgotten. As you've said, they were migrants, everyone here, except for the indigenous people are migrants.
Yeah.
So the novel's told from Betty's first-person point of view, but the voice is often quite casual. Like, she often interjects with, oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. And even at times, I think she kind of gives away a few things that will happen. So was that a bit risky on a narrative level to kind of do
yes,
that?
Yes, it's interesting that you raise that, because that was one of the things I really had to kind of work on. I wanted the idea that it's Betty as a 99-year-old woman telling us her story. So she's got the awareness and the insight about the world, but also about her own story after the event. So I wanted to sprinkle that through it, because I thought that was fun, and I thought it added a sort of layer of insight and depth to it. But I also wanted that when we're in the moment, when Betty is 11 or 17 or 21, that emotionally that character only knows what she knew then. So I it was a bit of a double game, and it was one of those things where I had more of Betty's, sort of Betty as the narrator, more of her interjections, and I had to prune some of it out. But I hope I got the balance right. I mean, people might have different views about that, but it was part of the fun for me of the story was understanding your own life and feeling compassion for your younger self and what she didn't know. Because I think that we can all do that.
Yeah. No, I thought the interjections really lent, as I said, this kind of casualness, or this kind of almost, it was almost kind of something ingenue about it, or something, as which was quite, enjoyed. So, like, Betty has a long life. I mean, it's 100 years, and so it's a long narrative. And I think we all know that the bare bones of real life aren't kind of enough to sustain narrative like that, especially, you know, with the bigger, bolder environment that we're all writing into now with reduced attention spans. So Betty's narrative wants us to believe that her life was actually engaging enough over that 100 years. So that must have been quite a challenge to keep the narrative going, I think, at some points.
So it was. So it was very important to me that every decade of her life be interesting and challenging and surprising. And obviously that's easier to do when someone's in their 20s. But it was very important to me that in her 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, she's still kind of doing something surprising or interesting, but still plausible. So, I mean, obviously, well, I was about to say more interesting things happened to Betty than would happen in a person's real life. But I don't think that's true. I mean, Betty's life is kind of, she's not exceptional. She's not, you know, she doesn't become some famous person, or she's not an outlier in her society. She's kind of, she's, because she's a sticky beak and she's up for anything, and she's clever and she's gets angry, she's often at the edge of, you know, she's at the edge of where her generation is at, but she's never out of step with her generation, I don't think. I think she's kind of, I hope that it's plausible all the time where she is, but that I just didn't never wanted to be this idea that someone's real life is over by the time they're 40 and then they're boring.
Oh no, I wasn't kind of meaning that, but I just remember a novel I wrote which was based on, you know, a real person, and I couldn't, and I just wouldn't let go of the facts of real life. And I think the novel kind of suffered as a consequence of that, because it needed me to step back slightly and see it as a novel.
Yes.
And then make a few changes to make it more exciting for the reader.
That's the beauty of fiction.
Yeah.
That I can, even though I hope each year of Betty's life, there's a plausible story, I was the, you know, god of the universe, and I could decide what happened to her. I mean, I suppose the time that I've pushed my luck a little bit with plausibility, but I think it's fun, so I hope I got away with it, was when she goes to live off the grid.
Mm.
And I think that hopefully that channels an impulse that a lot of people have. And I had other characters be horrified that a very old lady was going to do that. So I was trying to keep it, have her do bold things, but within a universe that is realistic about an old lady doing something like that.
Mm. But you, I mean, you did, you know, again, because it's 100 years, that's a lot of time, and you did use ellipsis to kind of help you move forward or jump forward, though often you did kind of go back into a summary of the years prior. But like over the summer, I read David, I'm not sure the pronunciation, Solyi's Fresh, the Hungarian man that won the Booker. And that's incredibly episodic.
Right.
And it is a period of life, of his life. It's not his whole life, but it's quite a chunk of his life. And it reminded me of Betty in that episodic kind of manner. Had you kind of used that as a strategy when you were writing?
Look, what I did was I had certain moments I knew I wanted to hit. So, for example, I knew I wanted, I mean, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read the book, I wanted Betty's son to be conscripted to Vietnam. So I had to have her get pregnant at the right point so that her child would be 20 in the right year. So I had certain markers I wanted to hit. And I literally had a chart with the year I was having all my characters born, because it was very hard to keep track of how old everybody was. But I've worked in TV, I think very structurally. So I would have file cards with each beat of the story that I was hoping to have. And of course, I couldn't fit in even a quarter of the things I wanted to fit in, because I didn't want the book to be horribly long. Mm. But I would lay out on my dining room table file cards with story beats in it. And if it looked like we were going for too long without, say, seeing what Pearl was up to, I would think, oh, I wonder what Pearl would have been doing in the 1970s. And then I would go off and have a little kind of muse on that. And often I would come up with some fantastic story that would excite me about what Pearl would actually be doing. And then I would see if I could fit it in. So I think I was conscious of trying to hit certain moments, historical moments, but not everyone, and certain life moments. But I also had to look after my other characters as well. But I could use them to fill holes. I could do horrible stuff to them that I couldn't do to Betty.
Mm. Yeah, because it is quite a large cast.
Yes. So I had to kind of, and part of the fun for me was knowing that when you meet those people on that boat in 1947, I think the promise of the book is you're going to find out what happens to them. And as a reader, I would enjoy that idea. So I had to kind of think about a plausible and interesting storyline for all those people as well.
Mm. So it sounds like you had quite a good plan before you started writing, or do you just go and see what happens? How do you write?
Look, this book kind of, in a way, the project, the whole of life, kind of set parameters whether I liked it or not. You know, like so there was a natural structure there anyway. I've flipped between planning and realizing that my plan is all wrong. So I'll plan to do something, but when I get into the sort of when I imagine myself into the emotional reality of the character in that moment that I planned, I might realize, oh, actually, that's not what it would feel like, or that's not what she would do, and then I have to reboot. But so it's always a tussle between planning and I guess instinct and the reality of writing a scene.
Yeah, like an organic process, yeah, really. Yeah.
But I try to plan.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's good to have a beginning and, you know, like largely a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I often find I then start dithering about my end, and it takes a long while, a lot of experimentation, and I usually come back to the end that I first kind of had envisaged. So
the trick with this book was that I really wanted there to be a true story moment right at the end, which is hard when a woman's 99. I don't want to say what I did, but I hope I gave people a little story surprise at the end.
So Betty reminded me a lot of David Copperfield in that there's a harsh beginning and a gradual kind of ascent. A very complicated weaving of truth and invention, as Dickens said of David Copperfield. So how true is that of Betty? I mean, you've alluded to this a little bit, that it is based on your mum's story, but how closely did you use that story?
So some of the early stuff is very much my mum. You know, a big family in South London and being evacuated in the war. And in fact, one of the most unlikely sounding stories in the book, the one about her getting a letter to say she gets into the special school and her parents hiding the letter from her, that happened to my mum. And then the migration to Australia and the working as a secretary, all of that is my mum. But my mother didn't have nearly as interesting a life as Betty, and probably wasn't as nice a person as Betty, if truth be told. So beyond that, I had all sorts of invention and used bits of my own life, like being a television writer in the 1980s, being an artist model. I suppose one thing that wasn't the specifics weren't my mother's life, but I think that the spirit of it was the sort of revelation of discovering feminism in the 1970s, particularly for a woman who was already in her 40s. That was I remember that. I really wanted to capture that of my mother's experience. And that idea of women becoming more angry and more politically radical as they get older, which I think happens to a lot of women, that was my mother too. So there were little bits of my mother's spirit in there. And the idea of somebody who's sort of got an intellect and a spirit that didn't have the chance to
really flower
as it should have. I mean, in the way Betty, I give Betty the chance that my mother didn't have.
So did your mother regret coming to Australia at all?
Never, never, never. No. She only came to do the 2 years. She was planning to go back, and then she never went back. And we didn't go back at all for 20-something years. She didn't go back at all.
Whoa, I mean, going back was so difficult.
Sure. So we went back when I was 12, and she thought, no. I had a much better. I don't know that. I think she had a better life, but she very strongly felt that my sister and I had
a much
better life than we would have had.
Some authors do seem a bit surprised when their work is classified as historical fiction. While you were writing it, were you aware that it would be classified as historical fiction?
I don't know. It's funny, you know, because I some of my favourite authors write historical fiction, like Rose Tremain and Hilary Mantel and Geraldine Brooks and William Boyd, and I would never think of myself as in that category, partly because I wasn't writing something based on particular people. I was writing fiction, so it felt like I had the license.
Yeah, I mean, that is a distinction in historical fiction.
I don't think I did, no. I mean, I was conscious of the fact that I was standing on my tippy toes of my ability, that I don't, you know, that I don't have a lot of skills in. I have skills in research for writing. Like, I've got a TAFE certificate in asbestos removal that I got to do it to write a book. But but I, you know, I don't have historical research skills. But I just, every time I got to an era, I would think, okay, and I would just immerse myself in, I would listen to the music. I would find endless images of fashion and food and streetscapes. And I would just kind of create it like a movie in my head of that era that she was in. And I suppose there's a point at which it's part of my life. You know, there's a point at which I catch up with, well, I don't catch up with Betty, but there's a lot of Betty's life is within my living memory. Yeah. So, no, I don't think of myself as a historical author, but I'm delighted if anyone wishes to call me that.
So was this your first historical fiction, or had you, mentioned there was a CYA.
I wrote a series called, back in the 1980s, there was a series called Palace of Dreams, which was on the ABC, that was about a Russian Jewish family running a pub in Darlinghurst in the 1920s. And I wrote two episodes of that, which was enormous fun. So I have done it a bit. But mostly I've done contemporary.
Yeah. So you mentioned you had done some research. Like how was that done, and what kind of standouts did you find in the research?
Look, there's things like Anne Summers' Damned Whores and God's Police that's very helpful. I things like when I was researching Betty coming out on the boat, I found this nun had written a journal of her experience on the Asturias in 1947, the trip that Betty goes on. And I only stumbled upon it because I was trying to check that it was plausible that 10-pound poms came as early as 1947, because I thought it seemed so early, but they did.
They did, yeah.
And in the process, I stumbled across this journal.
Where did you find that?
Just on a website. I was looking up, I was tooling around looking for stuff about to check that it was plausible. And I found this journal and that someone had posted on this website. And it was so valuable. And so even the weather is correct day by day on that journey. Not that it matters. But and obviously Betty's experience is very different to that of a nun. But so sometimes, to be honest, I knew I wanted to come out on a boat as a migrant, but the specifics of it I shaped around the research material I found.
Yeah, that's great. I had a similar experience when I was writing a novel with a woman coming from Italy between the wars, not after the Second World War, but I found a DVD, for God's sake, of someone who'd made a film of the voyage. It was roughly the same time, might have been a couple of years out. But the film went from Naples through the canal into Ceylon, Sri Lanka, across and into Perth and even into Sydney and Melbourne. So there was all this footage. Like, it was too much because, you know, I could have written the novel as just the voyage kind of thing. But it was just it was a gift to just have a set of eyes.
And you let that shape what you choose to do. There's great things out there too, like the BBC has done all these oral history interviews with people who were evacuated in the war, and they're all transcribed.
Wow.
So I could read 50, 60 accounts of an evacuee experience and pluck out what I wanted, mix it with my mother's story, and so you just kind of pluck whatever you can get.
Yeah, I think I've always been able to find those types of things, though, like particularly written things that someone self-published or whatever, like, you know, memoirs and things like that, which, you know, mightn't be particularly well written, but they've got gems of just observation in them and things. So, yeah, I think they're really worth trying to seek out. So when you're writing, at what point of your writing do you actually kind of start to hone your prose, you know, because I always think that's the last thing because it's such a big job, and if you're going to throw out chunks of it, but then other people, you know, have to get every sentence perfect before they can move on.
It's interesting you say that because I'm in the middle of the first draft of a new book right now, so I'm absolutely in that place you're talking about. I tend to want it to read pretty well straight away. I feel like that's the only way for me to tell if it's working or not. I mean, obviously I block out story and I'll scribble or quickly type in random bits and bobs that I know I want to put in later on before I put it into proper prose. But I tend to write fairly clean right from the beginning. It's all I know how to do. But it's funny, having said that, because I come from television and theatre where rewriting in response to notes is absolutely normal and required, I'm not precious about that.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the interesting things about fiction is that there's, I think generally in the publishing world, there's less rigour about story. There's rigour about copy editing, but there's less rigour about story, about interrogating, is this actually the best way around to tell the story, or does this piece serve the book, or should you remove it? That kind of real hard eye on story, I would like there to be more of that in fiction. And I sort of have to do it to myself.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because it seems to me that writing film or stage, you know, you've lost internal monologue unless you're having the literal monologue on stage. But so it seems to me there's less, it's harder to tell those stories in screen and stage than it is in a novel, because in a novel you can go into the person's head and situate yourself there and be quite intimate with them.
Yes.
So that it seems there's more artifice involved in film and...
Yes. Although, well, two things I'd say about that. It's really, really interesting stuff. Yeah. Two things I'd say about that. One is that one of the joys of writing fiction is that you're allowed to just tell the reader what somebody's thinking in their head. But one of the things I love about drama is that the process is actually mimicking what we do every day as human beings. I mean, we don't know what's in somebody else's head.
No, that's exactly right.
We're just decoding,
yeah,
based on what somebody says or does or doesn't say. And I love the sort of eloquence of that. And so to me, some of the best pieces of prose are where the writer is putting you in that position.
Yeah.
They're not telling you what people are saying, what people are thinking.
Yeah, they're slightly pulled back.
But and we're doing all that translating and decoding ourselves.
Yeah, look, I agree. But as a writer for film or stage, you're then reliant on the actor to really do their job, or the direction to do their job well. And I agree, in fiction, when you read things that are very kind of surface, appear to be very surfacely written, and you as a reader have to engage and actually decode, it's a much more satisfying
experience. Yes. I mean, there's the interior life of characters is accessible in a lot of different ways.
Well, yeah.
Sometimes by direct description and sometimes by inference. And I just think that's, I mean, it's one of those decisions that you have to make all the time when you're writing a particular moment, which way you're going to tell that bit of story. And sometimes you can write it one way and realize, no, actually I'm better off.
Yeah. Look, I think that's the interesting point, is that there's more than one way to do things. And you really, as a writer, that's part of your job to really make the most economic choices, in a way, I think, of how you can situate and tell something.
Or the most fun, or the most clear.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not a fan of obscurity. I'm not a fan of things being hard to follow. I like when I'm in a scene to know where we are and roughly what's going on, because if I can, then I can actually invest in the sort of emotional heart of the scene. But if I'm still busy thinking, hang on, where are we and who is this now? And a lot of fiction, contemporary fiction, is unnecessarily murky to me.
Yeah, look,
And it's rewarded as seen as sort of classier, but I think that's nonsense. I think clarity is hard to achieve well, but it's the right goal.
Yeah, I find a lot of writers, I think, are not concerned about the reader. A lot of times I think they just forget someone is, you know, really busy, really tired, whatever, and they've got to read this. And, you know, there's a certain necessity for the writer to take the reader by the hand and say, come on, I'll lead you through this. It might get a bit tricky at times.
I really agree. But I mean, and maybe for me it comes from writing for performance, where a little bit of writing for an audience, literally in front of you, so you can see when people are engaged or confused.
Oh,
or,
it must be such a different experience.
And so I think all the time about the reader, all the time. And I think I don't understand why other, why all writers don't do that.
Yeah. Well, particularly on, along, I often ask writers, you know, because it is largely a female profession, do they, you know, do they think about male writers and, male readers when they're writing? And they often look quite blankly at me. Like, you know, why would I do that? And to a large degree, if they're selling well, why would they do that? But
well, that's interesting because I guess my first read of everything I write is my partner, who's a man. So I guess I get a male eye on my work at the beginning.
So Betty ends in 2028.
Yes.
Which, I understand you needed 100 years of Betty, but it kind of seemed a bit dangerous to me in this kind of rapidly moving world that we're in now. Like, how is someone, you know, God knows what's going to happen by 2028, and how's someone in 2030 going to read it all beyond that? So
yes, I know. I know. I was worried about that, but in the end I decided that that's a kind of playful thing and I think the reader will go with it. I think there's a moment in 2016, 2017 in the book, when Betty feels that the world is particularly turbulent and upsetting, and it's when Trump was first elected for his first term, and that's when she gets so upset about the world she takes herself off to live in a valley off the grid for a year. And I suppose I hope that that chapter and the feelings Betty has about the world will cover how things are now, for example. So when the book went to press, when I had to submit the absolute last pages, it was when we didn't know the result of the 2024 election. And I remember thinking, how is this going to change everything? And I decided I can't try and guess, so I have to make the particularity of what's going to happen in the world in those final 3 years vague enough that it doesn't matter. But I think that Betty's feelings about what happened in 2016, 2017, when the world first started to feel like it was going to pieces, will cover whatever's happening now.
Mm. Why did you not shift it back those 2 years? Or I guess, yeah, you went to press before that, but.
Yes. Because I wanted it to be 100.
Yeah, but you could have shifted her birthday date.
Yes, I suppose I wanted her life to be. Maybe I was just besotted with the idea that it was my mother's generation.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
And because even if it had been the year the book came out, was the end of the year. There's still almost a year between when you'd find it and the book comes out.
Yeah, yeah, so. They would have. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the novel's in the form of a memoir. I'm just wondering who Betty was writing for.
That's a good question because, in some ways, the book that inspired me a bit is Any Human Heart, and that's written as journals by the characters that have been found by somebody and are being edited.
Right.
I guess she's writing for me. She's writing for by me, I mean younger women.
Right.
She's writing for her daughters and granddaughters and great granddaughters, I guess.
But she wasn't. I mean,
she's not. But she's a novelist. So by that point in the story,
that's true.
Someone who writes for our readership.
Yeah.
But I suppose if she has an audience, it's those younger generations.
Yeah. So how was it to get longlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize?
Oh, it was so delightful. I mean, it's delightful to think that anybody, because writers are sort of hungry, pathetic creatures with a bottomless void for validation. And particularly nice to be thought of as a historical novelist because as I said before, some of my favourite writers are historical writers, and so I have a lot of respect for that. So I think, oh, am I one of those? So it was great.
So Betty's been incredibly successful. So kind of what's next? What are you working on now?
So I'm one of those naughty writers who every book is completely different to the one before. So the book before Betty was quite a dark book about domestic violence, a thriller. And the one, yes, the new one is a kind of a comedy drama about a man, a very famous Australian painter who dies and leaves a testamentary trust that requires all of his children to do all these tasks. He's trying to control his children from the grave.
All right.
He's a horrible old narcissist. And so it's all these adult children dealing with the damage of their past and having jumped through all these hoops now. So it's a very different kind of book. But then again, it's still me. Do you know? I hope that people will. It might not be kind of as adorable as Betty. It's a bit spikier, but it's still me. It's still my kind of sensibility and that combination of I'm trying to be honest and heartfelt and funny and I guess as true as I can. Like I don't like pretension. So it's unpretentious and honest and, but maybe a bit more playful.
So is it set in present day and in Sydney? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's.
So I mean, argue that it's historical in the sense that there's flashbacks to the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a different sort of book.
Oh, good. Oh, well, good luck with that. And we'll look forward to it when it comes out. But thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Enjoyed our
great
chat because just for our listeners' sake, this was actually done in the flesh, as it were, because normally they're done via Zoom. So it's been lovely to have a Lamington and a glass of water while we've chatted.
Very good. Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.